Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
If you have heard of Antifa, this allegedly anti-fascist group that, well, spent a lot of 2020 and continues to spend a lot of its time protesting in the streets, engaging in vandalism and various acts of violence. If you've heard of them, you may have heard of them on social media, not so much from the mainstream media. Why is that? And why is one particular activity of Antifa, that is violence against reporters and journalists, why does that go unreported by reporters and journalists? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to talk about Antifa attacks on reporters. Joining us to do so, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Corporate Press Makes No Outcry Over Antifa Routinely Assaulting Journalists. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
In a general sense, why have the media ignored largely Antifa's activities?
The answer to that question is simultaneously obvious and complicated. On one hand, it's obvious in the sense that the media very much are a center-left liberal institution, and they are heavily invested and have been for some time in this narrative that even mainstream conservative ideology in America contributes to violence. Now, the reality is, in a country of 330 million people with very large political coalitions, there is going to be, you know, even in a country, I think, you know, is generally well-governed, although things seem to be fraying a bit on the edges, there's always going to be, you know, some violence on the fringes of large political coalitions. And, you know, both the right and the left are no exceptions. There was plenty of domestic terrorism on behalf of left-wing protest movements in the early 1970s, for instance. I mean, there were literally thousands of bombings that the FBI were responding to in the early 1970s. Now, of course, we have, you know, a situation here in the past, however number many of years, there's been a growing amount of street violence. And, you know, what we saw last year, you know, amounted to, you know, according to some military strategists, basically, you know, a domestic left-wing insurgency in terms of, you know, the billions of dollars in damages done by rioting and the dozens of people killed. The fact that Antifa are considered to be a left-wing movement by their openly stated ideology of, you know, anarchism and communism, the media are desperate to ignore the fact that they regularly engage in violence because they're afraid that that will be connected to, you know, mainstream liberalism, the Democratic Party, and all the other institutions that they like to support, the same way that they run around saying that, you know, every time that there is a mass shooting in America, that every Republican politician has blood on their hands because of their, you know, extreme rhetoric, you know, much the way that, you know, Sarah Palin was blamed by the New York Times for Gabby Giffords shooting at the hands of a man who was, you know, clearly mentally unwell, and there was no evidence to connect Sarah Palin's rhetoric to the shooting. So it's just, you know, a complicated battle of political narratives.
Just for the basic information, who are Antifa? That's also a rather complicated question, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Antifa is short for anti-fascist, and they trace their heritage back to some left-wing European groups that back in the, you know, early mid-20th century were actually fighting genuine fascists at the time when, you know, fascist groups like Nazis and, you know, Mussolini's brown shirts and stuff actually were stirring up violence in the streets, and there wasn't a necessity to send out people into the streets to counter the violence that the fascists were created. The more proximate rise of anti-fascists in the United States has a lot to do with sort of, it came out of a lot of, you know, interested punk rock organizations and things like that when there was starting to be racists that infiltrated punk scenes in various areas in the United States. So there were clashes between various punk rockers, those that were not racist and some that genuinely were racist. But over time, the existence of openly racist groups in America, well, you know, there still are openly racist groups in America we should be concerned about. You know, it's not like it was 40, 50, 60 years ago in the United States where, you know, the Klan Klan and stuff were still, you know, operating kind of out in the open. And as, you know, we've gotten, I think, a little better as a society in terms of tolerating the existence of these groups, and or, you know, we're just not producing as many people that are susceptible to those kinds of toxic racist ideas, Antifa has shifted all of their sort of, you know, ideology to this notion that, you know, anything that represents sort of mainstream or slightly conservative political thought is incipient fascism and needs to be, you know, met in the streets and encountered with violence. And what's interesting about that is they have gotten so expansive in their definition there that that has led to their hostility to a corporate press establishment that is, you know, nominally on their side and in fact, you know, covering for them.
What is the source of Antifa's hostility toward the press there?
So what it basically boils down to is that they feel that if you are not actively combating fascism as they define fascism, you are a fascist yourself. So again, they just basically walk out there and they say, you know, as long as the anarchist communist utopia that they envision doesn't exist, then you are impeding that and you must be a fascist. I talk in the article about how there was a few sympathetic academics, you know, who might very well be members of Antifa, have written books about the group. And, you know, they say as much, that as long as America is, you know, on the verge of incipient fascism, they completely disregard things like, you know, universal human rights that, you know, we define traditionally as Americans, like free speech, because the need to fight the fascists who are, you know, violently hurting people, never mind that there aren't brown shirts walking around in America, you know, beating up people for their skin color or whatever. That's just not happening. They just define that this threat of incipient fascism is so great that it requires you to suspend all, you know, regard for basic rights so that it doesn't impede their mission of combating fascism. It's all very sort of, you know, convoluted. I mean, you know, they've also made arguments that there's no point in respecting free speech in America because, you know, our incarcerated population doesn't have free speech rights. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, absolute madness. It just boils down to the fact that they're going to commit violence against anyone that doesn't agree with them. The press are certainly part of that.
Although the press largely has ignored Antifa, the few journalists who have tried to cover them have been met with, at the very least, the threat of violence, but in some cases, actual violence. Why is violence against journalists part of Antifa's modus operandi?
So there are two answers to that. One is sort of the, you know, abstract ideological reasons that I just laid out. You know, they don't think that the press can be trusted to tell their story because they believe the First Amendment and free speech and those kinds of things are, you know, really just tools used by the fascist establishment to keep political progress and, you know, from happening, from the communist utopia they want to create from being realized. And on a more, you know, tactical level, this is the thing about Antifa that I think most people don't realize. I mean, you know, Joe Biden's been running around and, you know, all the people on the left, you know, saying that they don't exist, for crying out loud. Well, you know, they are actually very savvy in terms of how they operate in the streets. And one of the things that they do is that they have these, you know, coordinated protest actions. And as part of those protest actions, one of the journalists I talked to for the piece is a woman named Nancy Rommelman, who's covered them extensively, who said that, you know, one of the things they do is they walk around, you know, people that are aligned with Antifa walk around, you know, with, like, you know, vests saying they're press and stuff like that, and announcing that they're independent members of the press reporting on what's going on, when the reality is they're aligned with Antifa. So what they do is they try and Antifa try and, you know, threaten and intimidate and, you know, outright attack people that are reporting on them at their protests. But then they have these independent, quote unquote, journalists wandering around that are really part of their organization that are taking photos and then leaking that information to other sympathetic reporters or whatever, so that they can actually control the narrative of what's happening at these events. So you get all these pictures that make it look like the cops are out there, you know, beating people up, but you don't get any pictures showing that Antifa is actually out there beating people up.
Who is Marinee Staub, and why is the coverage of her encounters with Antifa perhaps an aberration?
So Marinee Staub is a freelance photographer. She works for a, you know, left-wing startup that, you know, specializes in covering sort of, you know, street protest events. In the last, you know, year or two, there's been a big demand from news organizations, you know, for footage for that sort of thing. She was covering a clash between Antifa and what happened was a right-wing group in Portland was staging some sort of protest event in an empty Kmart parking lot in the fringe of the city. And of course, just their mere presence in the city, regardless of whether they have a right to be there or not, meant that Antifa was going to show up and, you know, cause trouble. So she was there, you know, waiting around to, you know, cover what was about to happen. And while she was there, the Antifa people were yelling and screaming at the press to, you know, to get out, and, you know, they shouldn't be there and all this other stuff. And so she put her camera away and she tried to talk to Antifa to work out a deal in terms of, you know, how the press could stay around and cover what was happening. And as soon as she got over there, they maced her and they, you know, beat her up and they, you know, shoved her to the ground and all these other things. And they called her a bunch of, you know, rather un-PC names for people that claim to be on the left. And of course, you know, this was all captured by all the other photographers that were there. She was kind of like singled out. It was interesting because as soon as this happened, the Society for Professional Journalists issued a condemnatory statement about it. Yet, you know, as we pointed out, that these journalists out there like Andy Ngo is famous for this. He's written a best-selling book on Antifa. He's from Portland. He's done extensive coverage of the group. You know, he ended up in the hospital with a brain hemorrhage, and the Society for Professional Journalists and a lot of these journalism organizations, you know, couldn't be bothered with the statement there. So, you know, a lot of people on the left, even when they saw what happened to Mirani Stab, you know, they had been ignoring this violence in the streets for so long. You know, as Nancy Rommelman, one of the journalists I talked to, you know, and she's a woman who considers herself on the left, was saying that there was this, you know, when she was covering Antifa, you know, events last year, there was this strong, overwhelming pressure in the press. It's like, you can't report on what they're doing because, you know, it will affect the, you know, election. We got to get Trump out of office. I mean, that's literally what, you know, she was being told. So this was kind of a wake up call, I think, for people on the left, where, you know, this was such a blatant attack on the press that, you know, people on the left started to realize, oh, you know, we can't just pretend to ignore this problem because we don't want the mainstream left to be implicated. And, you know, it's going to metastasize and get to a point where we can't ignore it. So then all of a sudden we got this Johnny come lately, you know, series of statements, you know, condemning what happened to Mirani Stab. I mean, you know, better late than never, but I mean, this has been going on for years, and we, you know, we've already let the problem get to a sufficient level that it never should have gotten to.
In a more general sense, violence against a journalist would ordinarily be a nationwide story, especially this kind of violence against a journalist, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, you got to remember when, you know, Trump started running for the presidency and he started saying things like the media were the enemy of the people and coming out with this media criticism, you know, people in the media establishment were apoplectic. I mean, they were, you know, just insisting that, you know, this was going to lead to attacks, physical attacks on journalists, and how dare the president be saying these things, and, you know, on and on and on. Well, meanwhile, you have a situation here where Antifa has been running around beating up journalists for years, you know, practically, and no one had been really saying anything, was concerned about the fact that they were committing this, you know, violence in the streets. And not only were they committing this violence in the street, they have an explicit ideology that, you know, says that they are licensed to attack the press and they disregard free speech. The disparity was, you know, really, really shocking, you know, especially since the media has gone out of their way again to cover right-wing violence, you know, when there's been angry protests, you know, over COVID lockdowns, or, you know, at school boards recently over critical race theory. You know, whenever people who are nominally on the right come out, you know, in the streets and act in any sort of aggressive manner, the media again plays up the threat of violence, you know, as, you know, this huge, huge problem. And if people on the right go anywhere near the media in terms of, you know, being threatening in any perceivable way, they play this up as this massive, massive threat. And there's just been a total, I mean, I'm not saying that people on the right haven't, you know, been too threatening at times, you know, and haven't been, you know, over the line in terms of their, you know, they're threatening the press in one way or the other. But the disparity in coverage between, you know, the fact that this also happens on the left quite a bit. In fact, journalists have been sent to the hospital with, you know, brain hemorrhages for covering Antifa. That is really revealing, and, you know, it needs to stop. People need to start paying attention to this, you know, because otherwise there's no point in caring what the media have to say about this. People are going to become inured to it, and more journalists are going to get attacked.
What role has social media played in both publicizing and at times suppressing stories of Antifa's violence against journalists?
So part of the other thing that's happening here is that the journalists that cover Antifa, and part of the reason why there hasn't been any sort of, you know, support from the media establishment is they've been beat up, is they tend to be from outside of the sort of legacy corporate media establishment. You know, Andy Ngo, the guy who's probably best known for covering Antifa protests and, you know, been subject to all that violence, you know, he's basically like, you know, one rogue journalist with a widely followed Twitter account where he posts all this amazing video and, you know, reports all these, you know, details about what's going on in the streets. And, you know, he's written a bestseller. I mean, he's not nobody, but he's definitely not part of the mainstream. Sorry, I hate to use the word mainstream in this context, because I think that the major media institutions are losing their hold on their audience. But the corporate media establishment has very much gone out of their way to downplay anyone that reports anything that contradicts their narrative, and more than that, like shows them up for not covering important stories. And so that's a lot of what's happening here. The people that do a lot of the coverage from Antifa, they tend to be either from publications that are, right-leaning, or they tend to be sort of, it's like upstart journalists who rely heavily on social media. And so that's played a big role in terms of how this gets covered, because the legacy media wants to, maintain control of the narrative, and these other journalists are very inconvenient for that. And in some cases, in Andy Ngo's case, whenever he reports this stuff and it goes viral on Twitter, people get really, really angry on the left, and they have actually succeeded in getting Twitter to, relabel some of the things he's reported and mischaracterize him as not a journalist, because they claim that he has a point of view and that, he's an activist. Well, sure, I don't think Andy Ngo's made any secret of the fact that he's openly critical of Antifa. But since when is being a journalist with an editorial point of view been, not made one a journalist? I mean, there are plenty of people both on the left and the right that are out there, reporting things within, stating their biases up front. No one insists that they should get to stop calling them a journalist. The Andy Ngo's problem is that he's very, very effective at showing Antifa is dangerous, and this reflects poorly on the left.
We're talking about Antifa attacks on reporters with Mark Hemingway. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "Corporate Press Makes No Outcry Over Antifa Routinely Assaulting Journalists." Here's a little bit from the Issues Etc. Journal's Wittenberg Trail feature by Jake Damick. He writes, "As I boarded the return plane at the deployment's end, I knew the war had changed me. I would never again see humanity the same. I would never see myself the same. Yet on the other hand, the war had given birth to something else. War with all its horror and power had demonstrated the greater power and work of Christ in the midst of a dying and horrid world. I was a young man who didn't know much other than the depths of the world's brokenness as I boarded that C-17 leaving Afghanistan, but I did know one thing. I was a Lutheran." You can subscribe absolutely free to the Issues Etc. Journal. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click the red subscription button. Enter your email address and we'll send it to you for free. When we come back, what about journalism advocacy groups? What have they been saying about violence against journalists?
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This fall in creation is bested by tornado, hurricane, flood, pandemic, and more. LCMS Disaster Response helps our congregations, their pastors, and other church workers to reach out to their members and neighbors with mercy which flows from Christ's altar. We offer quality volunteer training, help for congregational readiness and response, and disaster grant funding. To learn more, visit lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.
Your funeral is the last opportunity to make your confession, your final confession from the grave, as it were. In your funeral, you confess before the world what you believe and in whom you trust, Christ and Him crucified. The September issue of the Luther Witness will help you think through this final confession of yours. It will help you think through the funeral service, funeral arrangements, hymns, and more. To purchase your copy of the Luther Witness, visit cph.org/witness. To learn more, visit witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
The pursuit of truth is the best way to prepare students for lives of responsible freedom and vocational service in family, church, and career. At Concordia University Chicago, truth is one of the pillars of our education, and that makes all the difference for our students. I'm Dr. Eli Hesterman, Dean of the College of Health, Science, and Technology at Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Antifa attacks on reporters with Mark Hemingway. In about 15 minutes, we'll discuss caring for caregivers with Dr. Tyler Arnold of Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Mark, you have contacted several journalism advocacy groups about left-wing violence against journalists. What have been their responses?
Well, that's interesting. The Committee to Protect Journalists, you know, immediately turned around and gave me sort of a generic statement about, you know, violence increasing against journalists and how all journalists need to be protected, which was, you know, I think a sensible thing to do. Journalists Without Borders, which, you know, normally specializes in covering and condemning a lot of the violence that happens with journalists internationally, didn't respond to me at all. And the Society of Professional Journalists, I contacted both the local Oregon chapter, which had issued the statement condemning Marani Stab, and the national office in Indiana, and neither one of them got back to me. I finally emailed the entire board of directors at the Society of Professional Journalists, and the president of the organization got back to me as my story was going to deadline, saying she was really sorry. She didn't think she'd be able to get me a statement, you know, back in time, but she, you know, she did seem like she was concerned about the problem. But, you know, again, the lackadaisical attitude about this among the journalism establishment, I think, speaks for themselves. You know, it's not that I think that the Society of Professional Journalists isn't concerned about attacks on journalists. They are. It's just that they're so part of a liberal media establishment that it doesn't register with them on the level that it should. And when they do realize that they need to, you know, address these issues, you know, it's in some cases, you know, almost literally too late. But, you know, again, it just speaks to, I think, the corruption of the general media establishment. They pride themselves on this objective journalism model, but the reality is that they are deeply compromised in terms of pushing, you know, explicitly left of center narratives, and this makes them very, very blind to a lot of bad things that are happening to the media establishment itself.
You have mentioned journalist Nancy Rommelman. Go into a little more detail about what she's had to say about this subject.
So she's a very interesting person. She's got an extensive journalism career. She's written for all kinds of publications. She's written books. She wrote a very well-received book about a tragic murder in the city of Portland a few years ago. Her husband was a small business owner in Portland. You know, again, she considers herself a person of the left, but her husband operated small businesses in downtown Portland. Small businesses are constantly having their windows bashed in by Antifa and other things like that. I mean, it's been very difficult and traumatic to, you know, have to operate a business in downtown Portland. And so she got interested in covering this, and it was amazing. You know, again, she's the person on the left, but the moment she started reporting all the stuff that made the sort of the city of Portland look bad, you know, the journalistic establishment, the local journalistic establishment, I should say, was, you know, up in arms. You know, she had this really interesting report she did for Reason Magazine, which is a libertarian publication, where she talked about some of the things where she explicitly reported on some of the things I've already covered about how Antifa used their own propaganda tactics, where they suppress the coverage from actual journalists that might show up to cover their events while ceding their own hand-selected coverage to sympathetic reporters in the larger press. And she reported on that extensively. And one of the things that she reported on was like Antifa groups were circulating this spreadsheet that had a list of approved journalists that Antifa people would talk to. And on that list was a guy who had been, he doesn't work for the New York Times, but he was their stringer, as you call it in journalism parlance. He'd been covering, you know, the Antifa unrest at the federal courthouse last summer and other things, all the big protest actions in Portland for the paper, the New York Times. And he did, you know, a number of bylines in the New York Times covering Antifa. And Antifa considered him a friendly source. And she reported this. And that didn't look good. And, you know, the guy had, you know, friends in the establishment. And, you know, all of a sudden she had, you know, editors coming out and, you know, saying bad things about her behind her back because she dared to question what was happening with coverage in the city, whether or not, you know, people were being as independently critical of what was happening as they should have been. And, you know, she got a ton of backlash for it. But, you know, I think she eventually moved out of Portland. I believe she lives in New York now because it was impossible to stay in a city that was, you know, collapsing and, you know, operating a small business, you know, that her husband was doing was, you know, impossible.
How have right-wing protest groups generally been covered by the media?
I mean, I think anyone who's paid attention to what happened on January 6th knows what I'm talking about. I harbor no particular brief for, you know, what happened on January 6th. I mean, I found it repellent, and I don't think that, and I think the people that, you know, did those egregious things where they stormed the Capitol or whatever should probably face legal consequences. But the disparity in terms of the nonstop obsessive media coverage of these people being a threat to democracy and the sentences that they've been handed down in terms of, you know, these people being stuck in jail for months for, you know, walking into a, you know, building that taxpayers pay for the maintenance of has been, you know, really, really stark when you compare it to, say, the mass protests across the country last year where we had huge groups of organized people overrunning police stations and setting up autonomous zones in the middle of cities, or like in Portland, where they, you know, laid siege to the Mark O. Federal Courthouse for over a month, continually assaulting federal law enforcement officers. It's really, really astonishing that we're in this situation here where, you know, they're just clearly sending a message. Like, you can be a violent left-wing protester in this country, and the vice president of the United States will encourage people to donate to your bail fund. But, you know, if you are on the right and you're even thinking about doing something that is a matter of social unrest, then they're going to throw the book at you and, you know, you're never going to see the key to your jail cell again. And that's really, I think, been eye-opening for a lot of people. And I think, and again, I'm not saying the people on January 6th should not be held accountable for the wrong things that they did. I mean, absolutely they should. But the media coverage and the, you know, the actual treatment from the legal system, I think, is, you know, grossly disproportionate. I mean, people aren't really realizing how bad what happened last year was. One of the things I talk about in the articles, I stumbled across this, you know, piece from David Kilcullen, who was one of the architects of the surge in Iraq. He was, you know, one of the top deputies to General Petraeus. And he looked at what was happening and, you know, he concluded that, you know, based on what he had seen in Iraq and other countries, that when they say, oh, well, the protests were 93% peaceful. I mean, you know, normally when you're an occupying military force dealing with an insurgency, you're dealing with 2-5% of the population that's causing the problem. You don't get to say that 93% peaceful is a good thing. We've got 7% of people in a group that is responsible for billions of dollars of damage to cities across the country. I mean, that's a serious, serious political and law and order problem.
You had mentioned that Nancy Rommelman, one of her insights was that when leftist violence was being covered, particularly in 2020, the press generally covered incidents that also involved clashes with right-wing groups. Why is that an important insight?
Well, it is true that there certainly are right-wing provocateurs, groups like the Proud Boys and other things like that. But like when they stage a rally in Portland, Oregon, they're doing this knowing that Antifa is going to come out in force and oppose them. It doesn't mean that they don't have the right to assemble, because they do. But they know that just their presence in the city is going to cause some kind of violence. But as Rommelman pointed out, the media would really obsessively focus in on, when there was violence, when it was always a clash between groups like the Proud Boys or Patriot Prayers, another right-wing group that often does stuff in Portland. They would focus in on the clash between these groups to portray it as, some sort of here's the crazies on the right, here's the crazies on the left. When the reality is that the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer, don't roll through town that often, only a handful of times a year. And yet what's going on in Portland is you're seeing street violence like, last summer, especially like night after night after night after night, just bashing into windows. Like I said, they literally laid siege to a federal courthouse for weeks that had to be surrounded by walls and, armed guards. And I mean, it was, a nightmare. That was not right-wing people stirring up violence. That was, Antifa going out of their way to literally attack the foundations of, law and order in this country. And people need to understand that that's what's really happening. And this group is endemically violent, and it is not because they're being provoked.
Mark Hemingway is our guest, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. We're talking about Antifa's attacks on reporters when we come back. How does all of this relate to the media's coverage of Black Lives Matter? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Is your church celebrating a major anniversary soon? Ad Crucem can help with customized products to commemorate the event. We can create church banners, ornaments with an image of the church or your logo. We can even make stickers to hand out to members. We also recommend Kelly Schumacher create a painting of your church with matching greeting cards. Visit adcrucem.com and search for Church Anniversary for more details. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where, without baptism, infants go to heaven, and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming 3-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Job saw the city as a wasteland, as if devoid of God, witnessing injustice to the poor by the corrupt, lawlessness of criminals, trafficking of children, blatant immorality, thinking God could not see wicked deeds done in the dark of night. Yet God never abandoned Job, nor his city, groaning for mercy. God is working through the living Redeemer, hands etched with salvation, pointing to the resurrection to come. Join us at lcms.org/citymission to seek peace and shine the light in the city.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about media coverage of Antifa attacks on reporters. Mark Hemingway is our guest. He's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Corporate Press Makes No Outcry Over Antifa Routinely Assaulting Journalists. So how does all of this relate to the media's coverage of Black Lives Matter?
Well, you know, like I said, it really is just a function of the fact that they still want to really control of this narrative. I mean, they've spent decades trying to connect right-wing ideology or, you know, basic, you know, your average Republican voters to violence and trying to make the connection that, you know, anyone who voted for, you know, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush and God forbid Trump is really just, you know, an incipient fascist. I mean, like, they really have gone out of their way to portray, you know, all of these incidents. You know, I mentioned the Gabby Gifford shooting, and there have been many, many more, as being the product of right-wing, you know, or Republican rhetoric or, you know, basic conservative rhetoric, rather than, you know, sometimes people are crazy and they do bad things, which is, you know, often the, you know, more logical explanation. And I'm not saying that, you know, certainly there are things you can point to, you know, Timothy McVeigh's bombing in Oklahoma City, you know, clearly that was on some level, he was, you know, a right-wing guy who had, you know, very, you know, disturbing ideas about what should be done to fight the federal government, who had committed some, you know, serious excesses in the 90s in terms of, you know, law enforcement. So clearly, yes, there are times when you can connect right-wing ideology to violence, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that discredits the average Republican voter, and I think that's what the media's been going for. At the same time, you know, we just had a president, Barack Obama, who started his political career in the living room of a violent left-wing, unrepentant domestic terrorist, Bill Ayers, who was responsible for, you know, how many bombings were the Weather Underground responsible for in the 70s? I mean, there's very much a double standard in terms of, you know, who gets called out for accountability in terms of this sort of thing. You know, maybe there are times when we need to ask, you know, are people on the right being too excessive in what they are saying? But, you know, we also need to ask that on the left too. And the questions never get asked for the left, whereas the right gets assigned blame when 99.9% of the time, there's no logical reason to connect what, say, Ted Cruz said to some sort of mass killing. It's really patently absurd, and the double standard has got to stop.
Has media coverage of Antifa and other leftist groups changed at all from the Trump era to the Biden era?
Well, I think part of what happened with the sort of universal eyebrow raising and condemnation of Marani Staub back in August was Biden was president, so they didn't feel as threatened in terms of, they felt that they could deal with cleaning up their own house. And they felt that, you know, they had to sort of address this problem because they had learned that, for instance, even though they made excuses for all of the BLM protests all last year, there was plenty of polling data and stuff that showed that the reason why Democrats did poorly, why Biden barely won and Democrats did vastly underperform the polls and, you know, very nearly lost control of the House last year, when in a way that was totally unexpected, was because they backed all this BLM rhetoric and stuff, and defund the police, and BLM rhetoric is not in fact popular even among, you know, Black voters. So I think that they feel that A, they have a problem in their own house that they do need to address, and secondarily they just felt that because they were in a safer environment where, like, if them coming out and condemning Marani Staub and making a big deal about the violence, well, it wasn't an election year and Biden was president, and they weren't worried about giving aid and comfort to, you know, Republicans as much as they were a year before. So, I mean, that's not a good place to be. I mean, you know, you need to condemn violence wherever and whenever you see it, you know, damn the larger political consequences, because otherwise people are just going to learn to use those, you know, political incentives as cover for committing more violence. And I think that's what's been happening.
In that vein, contrast the media's coverage of Black Lives Matter and Antifa with that of the January 6th riot at the Capitol.
Well, you know, again, like I said, it was really, really bizarre to see some of the coverage that was happening on so many levels. I mean, the creation of autonomous zones in Seattle and Minneapolis and other places, where literally the mayors of the cities are ordering the cops out of sections of the city so that left-wing groups can establish their own rule. I mean, was absolute and total insanity. And yet there was no like broader concern about law and order for all this stuff. I mean, there was a famous news clip or whatever of the guy in CNN in Kenosha, Wisconsin, like literally standing in front of buildings in flames. And, you know, the crying underneath him says, you know, mostly peaceful protests. The cognitive dissonance was just absolutely mind-blowing. And I don't think that people at the time realized, one, how radicalizing this was going to be to a lot of people. I mean, when you excuse violence on one side, you're basically creating an incentive for, you know, the other side to commit violence, because you're like, because they're going to look at that and say, you know, why is it that I have to obey by the rules while these other people use violence to get their own way politically? Well, you know, they're going to, you know, naturally push back. And I think that that is a really, really dangerous place to be, because the media are not going to be able to suppress violence. That, you know, they can spin it, but they're not going to be able to suppress it if it gets out of control and we end up with, you know, both sides, you know, going after each other. So I don't know what's going to in the future. I don't know whether the fact that they actually, you know, came out of the woodwork to condemn one attack on a journalist, you know, means we're in some new era where they recognize the degree to which this is a problem. But this disparity needs to stop, because it's going to just create a cycle of violence.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. He's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled Corporate Press Make No Outcry Over Antifa Routinely Assaulting Journalists. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, Caring for Caregivers, Dr. Tyler Arnold will be our guest.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to deceit us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Have you ever attended a funeral and not known what to say? Or perhaps you did think of something to say and it was the wrong thing to say? Funerals are a regular part of life. As you age, they become even more common as your friends and family members pass through the veil of death. The September issue of the Lutheran Witness will help you think through funerals, your own and the others you attend. It will guide you through what to say at a funeral and how to plan your own. To purchase a copy, visit cph.org/witness. To learn more about the Lutheran Witness, visit our website, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues, Etc. congregational sponsor. Atonement Lutheran, Glendale, Arizona. Concordia Lutheran, Geneseo, Illinois. Grace Lutheran, Auburn, Michigan. Emmanuel Lutheran, Alexandria, Virginia. Messiah Lutheran, Lebanon, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Stevensville, Montana. Redeemer Lutheran, Mandeville, Louisiana. St. John Lutheran, Port Sanilac, Michigan. St. Paul Lutheran, Long Beach, California, and Trinity Lutheran, San Dimas, California. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.